So I've been thinking a lot about this, but I still don't have a definitive answer. If I had to be from another planet would I want to be from? I mean, how would you answer that question?
Well, I don't know, kind of maybe I might go with Mungo,
Mungo's good.
But then you've got Ming the Merciless as your emperor.
There's enough authoritarian regimes on this planet. I feel like you don't have to travel light years for that.
Pandora would be cool. I mean, and then, every 5 minutes you'd be like, this is Pandora.
You could do that. You could do that.
That's a thing you could do and annoy everyone you were with.
Their chief export is unobtainium. That's like your chief export being MacGuffinum 234.
Well, yeah, but then, could I go with the Venus from when Abbott and Costello go to Venus?
Yeah,
one that's just filled with beautiful women that even Abbott and Costello could have a chance with.
I have no reason to doubt the scientific accuracy of that movie. Oh no, dude! Obviously, the answer's easy. The Planet of the Apes planet. It was perfect. We should just go there
to the Planet of the Apes planet.
Yeah, the planet of the. It was a beach and then. Oh shit.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
To another fan-damn-tastic episode of Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, proof that white folks get stranger every day. And I am joined by my own brother from another mother, as well as possibly another planet, novelist/screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter @JunkFoodCinema, and you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Well, we don't stand on a lot of ceremony, so we'll just dive into this. It's February.
It's February.
It's February.
What is February? I know there's Valentine's Day, but it's not National Love Month.
No,
not National Matthew McConaughey Month, so we can't do that again.
Right. No,
I mean, it would be cool to do the best romantic comedies of Matthew McConaughey.
No, it wouldn't.
But yeah,
no, because
there really aren't. It's a very large list of films, none of which would qualify.
Yeah, if we change the name of the show from Junk Food Cinema to Hitting Ourselves in the Balls with a Crescent Wrench, then yeah, we'll do the Matthew McConaughey romantic comedies for a month.
What month is it?
It is actually Black History Month.
Ah.
And, when we did the written, or when I did the written form of the column of Junk Food Cinema, February was always Blaxploitation History Month because I have a huge soft spot for Blaxploitation.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought we'd do something a little bit different, maybe sort of along those lines.
Did you?
Yeah. That's what we came up with, and now I'm selling it as if this is a thing that just came to me on the air. Didn't take a month's worth of planning at all. Off the top of my head, I thought, why don't we do a month where we celebrate our favorite black character actors and their catalogs and the movies that they've given us that we've really loved.
And it gave us a chance to talk about a bunch of guys who we were going to do core episodes on anyway, who have been on our list, one of which has been on our list since the inception of this show.
Yep.
Like when you and I first sat on my couch and discussed what we wanted to do, we wanted to do an episode on this guy. And that's not tonight, but tonight... Tonight is an episode.
Way to bury the lead. Way to bury the lead.
Tonight is an episode I've been dying to do for quite some time because it's one of my deep fried favorite character actors. We've mentioned a number of his films on our show over the past year. One of which we've mentioned several times.
True.
And we wanted to do an episode on that. And now is the time.
Now is the time. Now is the time to sit back, relax, and celebrate the majesty of Joe Morton. Joe Morton, motherfucker.
Now, some of you may be sitting at home and going,
who's Joe Morton?
Who's Joe Morton? He's one of those guys. He's one of those that guys. He's one of those Dick Millers that he he can show up for 2 minutes in a movie and you go, oh, dude, I love that guy. And then he nails exactly what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, his character may never come back. But he's been in a number of classic films and he's been in a number of really cool, interesting, weird films. Yeah. And that's kind of what we're going to focus on tonight.
And he's been in so many movies that I wouldn't even begin to claim to have seen everything he's done. But I will tell you, I've never seen a bad Joe Morton performance ever.
No. He's one of those guys that you get Joe Morton every time. But
right.
But when he does something weird and oddball, he's really fucking great at it.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about his absolute best tonight, you know, his best performance tonight.
Yeah.
And then a number of really great performances.
Yeah. And I think what we'll start with, just touch on briefly, you know, a performance from a movie that we spent an entire episode talking about, a movie from the patron saint of junk food cinema, Mr. John Sayles, a movie from 96 called Lone Star that we covered during the McGenre Hay. Which, you know, we're not going to spend too much time on, but let's talk specifically a little bit about Joe Morton's character in Lone Star.
Yeah, Joe Morton, he's got this, he's one of the more interesting characters in Lone Star, in that he's the juxtaposition to the whole McConaughey, Chris Cooper relationship. I mean, the entire thing about Lone Star is about the father-son dynamic. And so we get this father-son dynamic of, you know, the legend and the guy who can't live up to the legend. But then we get this great, interesting arc of three generations of men all dealing with their father-son relationships. And you've got, you know, the young teenager who has never met his grandfather and wants to get in touch with his grandfather. We've got the grandfather who was a philandering bar owner, who went from woman to woman to woman over his life. And in the middle of that, we get Joe Morton, the guy referred to as the general, who is this guy who has risen through the ranks of the army and is this great, responsible, badass, hard-nosed, dick-swinging, military guy who just doesn't take shit from anybody, who's just now been transferred back to the small town that he grew up in. And he's now in the same town with the dad that left him and his mom to move two doors down in with mom's best friend. And he's never connected and always felt that his dad didn't give a shit about him. And unraveling that relationship between these three characters is really the heart and soul of Lone Star. You know, the meat and potatoes of Lone Star is the mystery, and it's the dynamic between Cooper and trying to live up to his dad. But you have this other through line that really nails all of the emotional beats of that wanting and the resolution that we can't see with Cooper and McConaughey, because McConaughey's character is dead. And Morton is just so great and nuanced in that performance.
Yeah.
He's just, you know, he's playing that hard-nosed guy. He's playing, you know, the just hardcore military guy, the kind of dad that I grew up with. You know, I'm a military brat, and seeing Joe Morton in that movie, I'm like, that's my dad. But there, you see him in those moments of passion where he's dealing with his father and dealing with the disappointment of not having a dad around, and you see how hard he's trying to not be that for his own son.
Right.
And it's just, and there's so much there. I think, honestly, it's the strongest performance of Lone Star. I think it's the most...
Which is saying something for that film.
And the film is, it's a John Sayles film who worked with Morton several times. And we're going to talk about another Sayles-Morton collaboration in a little bit. But, you know, you could tell it's one of those things where he had this important role and Sayles was just like, I got to get Joe for this. Like, I need somebody who can be that powerful and just intimidating, and at the same time have so much warmth and depth when he needs to. And that's what he brings here.
And I think it's really interesting to start with Lone Star. As I said, we did an entire episode on this back on November 18th. So Lone Star is a tremendous film. You should all go back and watch it. Then you should go back and listen to that episode. But I think it's important to start with Lone Star because in that movie, he's playing a general. He's playing somebody in a very authoritative person, a person in power. If you look at the catalog of roles played by Joe Morton, you see a lot of general this, agent that, professor that. He's always playing roles of somebody in a position of power or in a position of authority, and he does it tremendously well. Yeah. And I think that's why the next movie we're going to talk about is such an interesting turn, because even though it is early in his career, it's already against type for him. And of course, that movie, jumping from sales to sales and turning to one of Cargill's deep-fried favorites of all time...
Brother from Another Planet!
1984's Brother from Another Planet.
It's the Brother from Another Planet. It's John Sayles' dazzling and propelling comedy hit.
You've talked about this movie a number of times, Cargill, so I kind of want to let you kick this off and just tell me, what is it about this movie that you love so much?
Well, first of all, this movie is experimental as fuck.
Yes,
like, everything about this movie is experimental. The soundtrack, the writing, the structure, the characters, the fact that we have a protagonist who doesn't speak.
Doesn't say a word.
No, he's mute. And the way Sayles handles the information, just everything about this is so experimental and so cool and so deep that it's just such a wonderful film. And I think the reason this stands out so much in my memory is because of the film's trailer. And in the history of film, I doubt there is a trailer more misleading than the trailer for Brother from Another Planet. They cut a rap song in which Joe Morton raps on, which is the theme song of the movie, which appears in the movie for about 20 seconds.
Wow.
Supposedly on some kind of boombox or something, supposedly passing by in the street. And it's a fun little song, and it's a goofy, you know, very 80s, early 80s rap song called Brother from Another Planet.
The brother from another planet, yeah!
And that is in the trailer, and the trailer has all the weird comedic beats in the movie taken completely out of context to sell it as if it's this zany, crazy comedy about an alien coming to Earth. And you watch the movie, and it is a deep, profound metaphor for science fiction metaphor for the Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. It is all about this slave, this alien slave on the run from his slave masters who's come to Earth to hide out and doesn't understand the culture, has no idea where he is, can't speak the language. And so this is where Sayles is integrating two narratives at once. He's talking about this country's history with slavery and juxtaposing it against how we treat immigrants in this culture now.
Yeah.
And it's in mid-80s New York, which is still crazy and still crumbling.
Way pre-Giuliani.
It's just before Giuliani, you know. It's just before he came in to clean things up. That, you know, parts of the city are still falling down. It's crumbling. It's, you know, it's very racially divided. Racism is so, you know, so inherent that it's almost ambient. Like, you know, just racism is just everywhere.
And it's interesting the way he depicts it, because what I think is the most interesting scene in that regard in the movie is these two computer geeks, these two white computer geeks who are in town for a conference, and they're talking to each other and they're talking about these different places they want to go, and they look up and they realize, oh, we're in Harlem. And one guy just says, oh, that's not where we want to be.
That's not where we want to be.
And nobody says anything. There's no, like, confrontation. But just all of a sudden, it's just, like, really palpable that they become terrified. And there's this extra. I don't know if this was intentional or if this is just one guy who didn't know they were shooting a movie, who just kind of stands in the background and kind of leers, not at the two guys, but sort of toward the camera. And the mixture of that and the sudden just tension of these two guys when they look up, just realizing they've crossed 110th Street, it's just like all of a sudden, oof.
But the wonderful thing about that scene in particular is that when we then see them later in the bar, they actually are racist, but in a non-racist way. Like, yeah, they've got that, hey, it doesn't matter that we're white, we're all people, and we're going to be so blissfully unaware of racism that that's all we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's
post-racism.
Yeah, no, it is. And that's what's so great about what Sayles does here, and why I love this movie so much, is the interesting thing about this film is that it's, you know, Sales at this point in his career has already written a number of genre films, and he's already written a number of really good genre films. He understands what he's doing, and this is something he's clearly making for himself. And the style of writing in it is this very kind of mid-80s New York, Eric Bogosian-esque style of writing, where almost every scene is like a play.
I also love that Bogosian is a name that can be a name and the adjective for that name.
Or, yes.
It's very Bogosian.
Yes, it's very Bogosian. And well, I mean, like, one of the hallmarks of this movie is the scene where Joe Morton first wanders into the bar that becomes the centerpiece of the movie. And you have four characters in there, and they're all in the bar, and each character is having a completely different discussion. But they're all talking to each other. So you've got one guy, you know, a classic character actor whose name I'm blanking on at the moment.
Is he the guy that's also in Demolition Man?
Yes.
Who's always an old man, even when he's a young man.
Yeah. Even when he's a young man, he's always an old man.
I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, and he's got, you know, he's going on about germs and space germs and germs this and germs that, while another guy is you know, discussing with his girlfriend what they're going to go out to eat that night. And the other guy is just fascinated by this new guy wandering in, you know, bothered by the fact that nobody else is bothered by this strange guy who's wandered into the bar, while another guy is constantly complaining about the video game that he's playing not working and constantly bumming change from everybody so he can keep playing this broken video game. And it's just, it's so much like a play, and yet there's a very deliberate narrative going on, mm-hmm. and it's all fascinating, and it's never boring, and the film is filled with those scenes.
Yeah.
And the way Sales communicates what Joe Morton's alien is thinking, his brother from another planet. We'll just call him the brother because that's what he's called in the credits. What the brother is thinking is purely through Morton's performance. Mm-hmm. And Morton just does this amazing job, never being allowed to say one word. In fact, there's a moment where he screams and he can't even scream, and he screams silently. Mm-hmm. And that's what tells us he's a mute. And from that point on, he's trying to communicate, but he doesn't really cheat either by using his hands or writing or anything like that. He uses his hands for a handful of things, and even then he doesn't use them in the easy way, like when people are like, where are you from? He gives them the thumbs up.
He doesn't just point up, he just thumbs up. Yeah.
And it's so alien, and it's so wonderful, and we get this entire narrative that's you know, nearly 2 hours, mm-hmm. without this character ever once telling us where he's from or who he is. And by the end of the movie, you've completely figured it out.
And I think it's interesting too that Sales is able to have a character that drives the movie who is essentially lost, who is wandering through a city, who doesn't speak. You put that concept in the hands of a less talented director, that movie is going to meander like crazy.
Yeah.
That movie is going to feel very aimless. And yet in this movie, you never feel that, mostly because, one, yes, Joe Morton's performance is absolutely outstanding, and he communicates more in a single look or a single gesture than a lot of actors can do, you know, with an entire script full of dialogue. And the other thing, though, are those discussions, are those conversations that are going on that feel like just atmosphere, feel like just ambiance. And then you really start to listen to him, and you understand that Sales is making a statement about how complicated the racial discussion is.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite, you know, Bill Cobbs, who's the character actor you mentioned, who is always an old guy even when he's a young guy. If you listen to what he says, I don't think you see his face more than one time, but you hear him a couple of times kind of having conversations with himself because nobody's really engaging him. But he talks about alien dust and it coming down on the satellites. And he also has this weird, long self-diatribe about, I believe it's Haitians. And it's like, you catch diseases from them. You gotta be careful because Haitians carry diseases. And you realize that everything this guy says, every conversation he has with himself in one form or another, is about xenophobia.
Yeah.
He's afraid of everything that's not him. And you also have to take into consideration that later on in the movie, you get introduced these two, bounty hunters, these bounty hunters from the same planet, who
played by
John Sayles himself. And David Strathairn.
Yeah.
Yeah, David Strathairn, you know, future Academy Award nominee, David Strathairn.
Yeah, yeah, and they're playing this. They're playing the Men in Black.
They are totally the Men in Black.
Before there was even the comic Men in Black. You know, yeah. This is from the old school, like, crazy conspiracy theory Men in Black. And they're kind of the comedy of the movie. Yeah. Like, they're playing it zany and weird in a wonderful way that's hilarious.
They're called Uno and Dos, and they are, I mean, they're part bounty hunter, part intergalactic bureaucrat. Because it seems like all they're really doing They're immigration, you know, agents. And they're, like, trying to track down someone who has entered this country illegally. Entered this planet illegally.
Yeah, they're runaway they're slave hunters.
But I love the fact that even as John Sayles is doing this movie where he's shining a light on the difficulties of, you know, African-Americans and illegal immigrants, he's not painting himself as this hero who's above all of it. He's literally casting himself as the villain.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really interesting angle to take. When you write him, first of all, I can't speak to how authentic this movie is for the black experience at the time, because I neither live in that time nor am black. But
I'm not.
It's crazy. But I think it's really interesting that even as John Sayles is kind of painting this very deliberate and this very complicated mosaic of, you know, racial and xenophobic tension in New York, even though he's got kind of an outsider's view, he still kind of casts himself as the villain, not setting himself above it or outside of it. And it's a weird kind of paradox that I think he pulls off very well.
And just about every scene in this movie is about race, even when it doesn't seem to be. Like, it's so well crafted, and it's such an interesting way to interpret and tell that story, and to do it through genre, and do it through all these interesting characters, because that is one of the big elements of this movie. Is it really is almost everyone in this movie at some point in time does or says something that's racist.
The guy that owns the arcade is an interesting character, because he's saying really offensive racist things, but pairing them with what he thinks are compliments for racists.
Yeah, like he's got that great moment where he's like, you know, that's the thing about the Latinos is you always get an honest day work out of them, but they never come back from lunch on time.
Yeah. Or black guys are really good with their hands, but they have no managerial skills.
Yes.
Like, he thinks that by, like, doing a compliment sandwich, you know, like, where it's like something good and something bad at the same time, that it kind of evens out.
Yeah.
And it's still just, he doesn't.
And he still comes across as painfully racist. But even then, you've got that, you've got one of his employees who is really indifferent to Joe Morton until he begins to think that Joe Morton is actually from his same country.
Yeah.
And then that he's like, oh, you're one of the black guys from my country. Oh, we're countrymen, and all of a sudden now we're best friends.
Yeah.
And, like, even to the point to where when the Men in Black show up, he plays the no habla inglés, you know, and is like the, I'm sorry, I don't speak, you know, your language. And, and plays that whole dumb immigrant card because he doesn't want to talk to these white guys who might be after, you know, his fellow countrymen. So it's so weird in how he manages to milk a little bit of that out of everything. There's the, you know, the great, conversation with, the woman he ends up staying with, who's a white woman from Mississippi who fell in love with a black man, got knocked up, and then the black man took off and now spends all of her time with, you know, her mixed race son, which she can't take back to Mississippi because she explained, I burned that bridge when I had my boy. And spends all of her time with the woman who would be her mother-in-law.
Yeah.
Like, but isn't, because, you know,
the guy ran off.
Yeah. And it's just so it's, you know, even characters like that show how weird the race issue was when, you know, and this movie's very of its time. It's very, very mid 80s. But it's just so how he handles all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And everything about it is, you know, it's not a subtle movie. I'll say that, you know, but it can't be subtle. You know, he lays very thick on the Underground Railroad stuff at a few points because he never explains what's going on. And you can only through that context understand the final scene of this movie, which is so fucking cool.
And there's right down to the fact that there's an overt shot of a lawn jockey mm-hmm. that really has no other reason to be there.
Yeah.
And yet, now what I think is interesting though about the decision to have Morton not speak is that when you think about the two exterior factors that tend to influence how people judge each other without knowing them, it's the color of their skin and the language they speak.
Yeah.
So we have a character who, by the color of his skin, people are already assume. But if you notice in the movie, they assume a lot of different things about him.
Yeah.
They assume he's from South Bronx, that he's from Harlem, that he's from, he's from Puerto Rico. Yeah. You know, like all these.
When he gives
things.
A thumb up, they're like Uptown.
Uptown. He's from Uptown. And then when you take the language away from that, like that gives them no other corroborating evidence. So they have to go by their very first snap judgment of him.
Yeah.
And that's what creates a lot of the strange racial relationships between people in this movie. And yet, you know, while this movie does have a cynical view of New York in a way, there's also that moment where you realize that, like, by taking that language away from the character and by having him just be kind of a babe in the woods, completely naive, he's always assuming the best of people because he has no prejudices. He's prejudice-free. It's kind of this weird sort of, like, idealized America at the same time. Like, just under the surface of this really kind of grimy New York falling down, everybody's racist, whatever, when you think about it in the context of Joe Morton's character, of the actual brother from another planet, it's kind of a sweet, idealized America at the same time.
Yeah, well, he's very in love with New York City while he's talking about, you know, some of the seedy underbellies of it and the rough part and the poverty of it. There are all these wonderful, majestic shots of the city, like these, you know, that made me really nostalgic, too, you know, because there's several shots where he frames it with the World Trade Center. And just seeing that and seeing that in context from its time and just how in love Sales is with that skyline and seems to be sharing that his love of the city while he's, you know, criticizing it, mm-hmm. I think it permeates this entire film. You know, you've got, you know, he's talking about the wonders and the joys of the human race while he's showing what's wrong with us all at the same time. And I think that's very much what this film is. This is somebody who's very conflicted, who absolutely loves all of these things, but at the same time, feels that he needs to share us warts and all.
Yeah.
And I think that's, and I think that is something that goes to, you know, goes further with Joe Morton's alien, he's referred to a couple times as Three Toes, mm-hmm. By the Men in Black. He's got these huge monstrous, like he looks like a human being except for his feet, which are just these crazy, disgusting monster feet. Mm-hmm. And I think that plays into the overall theme of what he's doing where, you know, everybody, you know, everything has this flaw to it. Even this perfect, innocent, character who cares for all these other people who he has no reason to care. You know, he cares for this junky kid who threatened his life.
Yeah.
And wants to get revenge for, you know, for how he died, because he feels pity for him. Even this kid, this guy has this monstrous feature, mm-hmm. That he has to hide from the world. And I think we see that in so much of what this movie is.
Well, not only that, but the whole idea of the issues not being as clear cut as we might think. Just look at the ending of this movie. The ending of this movie is actually really sweet and hopeful because throughout the whole movie, while Sales has this undercurrent of talking about the struggle of not only African Americans, but just illegal immigrants in general, you have a moment at the end, and spoiler alert, I have to talk about the scene
because
it really affected me. You have this moment at the end where Joe Morton is running from the Men in Black. And he runs into, all of a sudden, you realize he's not the only alien from this planet who has escaped to Earth.
And
he runs down an alley and runs into a whole fleet of people standing here who have escaped these same people.
Yeah, and the beautiful thing about that is it comes out of the blue. You're just like, what the fuck? Except that when you go back and rewatch it, all the clues are there. Because the thing is that he's staring at all this graffiti throughout the whole movie. And you think he's just, a kid in a candy store, you know, just fascinated mm-hmm. by it. But he's looking for the symbols of his people because he knows there's others there. And then at the end, while he's being chased, he starts seeing the special graffiti that, you know, he had just had a scene with before and left a message that he's there. Yeah. He writes something in his own blood on the wall to let them know, I'm here.
Which is, again, another kind of reference to the Underground Railroad.
Yeah, yeah. And he sees the graffiti and starts following the graffiti down the tunnel, down the alleys to where he knows he might get help. And then sure enough, there is. And they greatly outnumber the Men in Black. And the Men in Black just know they're fucked. Mm-hmm. And it's such a great moment.
But the moment I think that really gets to me is after that happens, after the Men in Black are defeated, and Joe Morton's character realizes that, you know, some of his people have also escaped to this planet, he raises his thumb up as if to say, are we going back? And the, you know, one of the other aliens who also doesn't speak just points his thumb down. It's like, no, this is where we live now. And it's just such a beautiful moment. And then the final shot is Joe Morton on the subway. And it's like, you realize he wasn't telling him to get on the subway. He was saying, you know, this is our home now. Like we have settled here, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah, and it's the immigrant story, you know. You come here for a better life, but to have that better life, you have to be here.
Yeah.
And the movie's just so profound in its silence, and all of that great writing is then, you know, woven together with this really experimental soundtrack that is just really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And really it's the most analogous film to it, to what it sounds like, is it sounds kind of like Planet of the Apes, mm-hmm. you know, the original Planet of the Apes. It's, you know, it's just a lot of weird instruments and a lot of silence and it just drives that, coupled with Morton's silence. It just drives home the feeling of alienation and the feeling of being lost and confused and just it all comes together in this really brilliant experimental little genre film.
And Sales has talked about what inspired him to do that kind of music was the zither music in Carol Reed's The Third Man, which also creates a very kind of strange, otherworldly, discombobulating feeling. So I think that's exactly what he was going for. And, you know, I have to talk about for a second, there's a lot of, you know, we talked about David Strathairn, who actually worked with Sales a few times.
Yeah.
Showing up in this movie. It's surprising to see him. There's also a baby face young Fisher Stevens.
Oh yeah. With this really great, interesting scene.
Yeah.
It's one scene, but yeah, he's so young in that movie and it's him doing a card trick and then him making the most profound racial comment of the entire movie, which is, you want to see me do another trick?
Want to see me make all the white people disappear?
125th Street next.
And then they come up to the last stop in the white part of New York City, and all the white people get off the train. And Fisher Stevens gives that look, and he's just like,
the look that's basically, ta-da.
Ta-da. Yeah. No, there's a lot of great little character actors with small walk-ons here. Another person I'm blanking on his name, not anybody big that a lot of people would recognize, but the bar owner.
Steve James is the name of that actor.
Yeah, who was in a lot of stuff in the 80s.
Oh my God, yes. I know exactly where you fucking know him
from. Yes, American Ninja.
I was just saying, his co-star is Michael fucking Dudikoff.
Of course. He's American Ninja and American Ninja 2. And this is, yeah, of course, yes, no, he's... Yeah, and this guy, anyone who's seen the American Ninja movies knows exactly who I'm talking about. Now they're like, oh, that guy, yeah, he plays, you know, and he does this, has this really cool, you know, performance as this very, you know, down-to-earth, very kind bar owner who just kind of is running a bar where he's taking in all these strays of, you know, people who don't belong together but all kind of hang out together.
Yeah.
But the movie's just filled with just these small moments where it's like, hey, wait a second. What is that guy doing here? And they're there for a scene and they're gone.
And the epitome of that is, you know, we talked about this movie not always being the most subtle. There's a shot where Joe Morton's character is walking along and he looks in a window and he sees a lot of very elaborate crucifixes.
Oh, yeah.
And then he turns around and there's a man being frisked by a cop, almost making the crucifixion pose. You know who that is?
No.
That's Giancarlo Esposito. That guy getting frisked by the police is fucking Gus Fring from Breaking Bad.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's just
I did not know that because you don't really get a good close-up of his face.
He's not even credited in the movie. You have to like dig and find that out. Like it's crazy to me that there are so many great character actors in this movie that is helmed by a great character actor that it's just it's so much fun to sift through. And it's really brilliant sci-fi because it's the kind of sci-fi that has it has social weight behind it. It's not just science fiction for the sake of spectacle. In fact, it strips a lot of the spectacle away.
Oh, yeah.
We don't even see the spaceship.
No. The deepest this gets in terms of, the type of sci-fi you'd expect from 1984 is the opening sequence inside the cockpit. And and we get this stuff inside the cockpit, and then that's it. And then from then on, it's this guy with ugly feet wandering around New York City trying to find his way and trying to find a home.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic film that I highly, highly recommend and obviously has been one of Cargill's favorites for a while. So Brother from Another Planet also has a spiritual grandfather in Roger Corman. Yep, there's the Corman alarm. So Sales got his start with Corman, as did, as we've mentioned before, Little Jimmy Cameron.
Yeah.
Sales and Cameron worked together in Battle Beyond the Stars. And the same year that Sales made Brother from Another Planet, Cameron made this sci-fi flick called The Terminator. So jump ahead to 1991, Cameron makes the sequel, Terminator 2, once again with his producing partner and another class of Corman graduate, Gail Ann Hurd.
Yep.
And guess who's in Terminator 2?
Joe Morton.
Joe Morton plays Miles Dyson in Terminator 2, which I don't even think, like, if you've seen Terminator 2, you probably know exactly who I'm talking about without me having to explain. But if not, Miles Dyson is the guy who is, before things, happen in the movie, the guy who's kind of accidentally directly responsible for Judgment Day.
Yeah.
Because he's a high-ranking employee at Cyberdyne, and he's one of the guys working on we found this arm at this industrial plant, this robot arm, and now we're building processors. Again, it's that whole kind of like, start thinking about it, but he's the guy in the movie who Sarah Connor decides has to go because he's the guy who develops the technology that eventually leads to Skynet, yada, yada, yada. But Miles Dyson, I think, could be a very minor character, could be a very forgettable character in this movie, but for two things, and they're both Joe Morton's performance. One is that Morton is just plain, he's just likable in every, because he's not a character who is out to change the world. He's, or at least not in the way that it happens. He's very much just like, oh, we need to study this. He's a scientist. He's a very analytical view of the whole thing. Oh, we just need to study this. But as soon as he's told about what's going to happen, he's like, okay, well, I'm quitting Cyberdyne. Like, there's never that moment where he's just like, oh, you people are crazy. There's no way I'm going to do that.
Once he realizes what the future is, he's on board and he's like, well, we're not going to let this happen.
Yeah.
I get the power to stop this. I'm stopping this right now.
Yeah. And then the other thing is that he's the only likable character in the movie who doesn't know about Judgment Day at the beginning of the film. Every other character in this movie, for the most part, is somehow involved with or knows about Judgment Day. And the few characters that don't are not super likable. Like, the few I could list on one hand, you got, like, Danny Cooksley, who plays Edward Furlong's best friend. Listens to Guns N' Roses, is a terrible mullet. No, thank you. Then you have John Connor's foster parents, whatever. The only likable character, in my opinion, in this movie, who doesn't know about Judgment Day at the beginning, is Miles Dyson. So Miles Dyson becomes this like secondary sounding board for the audience because they have to explain everything about what's going to happen. And even though there is a lot of narration in the film, and as much as there is a carryover from the first one, I think that's what makes him so memorable in this movie, is that he's the only likable character who doesn't know everything that's going on at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, he's our surrogate. He's what we would be reacting to, this terrible future.
Yeah.
And of course, Morton is he's just great. He's so fucking memorable in that movie. Of all the people that are in that movie, when you mentioned Miles Dyson, everyone in the audience is like, oh. In fact, I'm willing to bet that there's a percentage of the people listening now that didn't know who you're talking about, but we're going to look him up later, who all of a sudden like, oh, I know who this guy is.
Yeah.
Oh, why didn't they just say that to begin with? Miles Dyson, that's his real name.
And then, of course, Slight spoiler, although this is Terminator 2. This is not this is not an unheard of gem we're unearthing for this episode. His death scene in this movie is so hard to watch. Not just because he's so likable, but because, man, those final moments are rough. It's not, you know, shot, fall down dead, never gets back up. It's like this very slow, very cold. He's got like a shiver, and he just like, it's like when you're a kid and you start crying so hard that you like can't get enough oxygen in you. So you're just like kind of doing that over and over again. Like, those are his last moments on Earth. And even then, he's like holding the trigger to the grenade that's like hovering over the switch. So as soon as he goes, he's going to take out Cyberdyne. So he's like, he gives them a chance to get away. So even in his last moments, he's being heroic, even though he started the movie as the guy accidentally directly responsible for Judgment Day. Mm. There's nothing easy about any character that he plays. And yet, again, a position of authority, and yet plays it with so much charm and amiability. And he's one of my favorite parts of Terminator 2. I love that section where it's like Miles Dyson and the robot crew from the future trying to stop Judgment Day. Yeah. I would have watched a whole cartoon series that was just the Miles Dyson Adventure Hour.
Miles Dyson Mysteries.
Miles Dyson Mysteries. Yes. Yes. I left Cyberdyne and I'm doing fine. And now we're going to solve some mysteries. I would watch that every day. They made a cartoon out of... They're going to make a cartoon out of Rambo and RoboCop.
Oh, yeah.
Why the hell couldn't we have gotten this?
And Toxic Avenger.
And Toxic Avenger. Where is my Miles Dyson Saturday morning cartoon show? That's what I'm asking. I feel like it's a legitimate question. Who do I need to write to make this happen? Joe Morton's still here. We can... You know what? If you think about it, the new Terminator film is basically presuming that everything that happened in that first movie didn't happen, which would further presume that everything in the second movie didn't happen. Miles Dyson could still be alive. He could still be alive, guys. Oh, sorry. I just got really excited about that.
You got really hard for a second.
I did. But whereas Terminator 2 is, like I said, a gem that we don't need to tell you about because it's not a gem. It's one of the biggest blockbusters of all time. The final movie we're going to talk about is exactly the opposite of that. It is something of a buried gem. In fact, when it was made, it never was released theatrically in the United States. It was only released theatrically in France. Huh. So that should give you a good idea of how buried this movie has been. And in fact, Cargill and I had to resort to watching it on YouTube because there was no way to get a hold of the damn
thing. Actually, no. It's on Amazon Prime. I watched
Prime. Oh, it's on Amazon Prime.
It's on Amazon Prime, but whatever version is on Prime is actually the made-for-TV cut.
Oh.
Where there are a few little awkward cuts to take care of.
So you watched both then to see the
difference? No. I thought that whatever was on YouTube was probably...
It was not cut. There's an even more violent version out there somewhere.
Well, I don't know how much the violence was different. The swearing is what tipped me off, because there are a few weird edits, like sounds like stutter dialogue.
Yeah.
And then there's a moment where somebody, I believe it's actually Joe Morton, says, well, somebody's diaper is full of, and then you hear a door slam, and it's...
Wow, now the version I watched on YouTube definitely does not remove the swearing, so that's interesting.
Oh, so we've watched two separate
versions. I watched The Clairvoyant, and you watched The Killing Hour. Maybe that's how it breaks down.
I did watch The Killing Hour. Yeah, these both have the same, you know, these have two different titles. And this
from 1982.
Yeah, and we had not seen this, but by reading the description of it being a Joe Morton movie, it was just like, this is a movie we need to watch whether we end up talking about it or not.
Yeah, it was a Joe Morton, it was a serial killer movie. It had an Italian director, which I'm sorry if it's in the 80s and has an Italian director, I'm at least going to give it a shot.
Yeah.
That's just how I do. But this is a really strange movie because I was expecting something really trashy.
Yeah.
Like, I was expecting something that was, you know, you could see the VHS cover like in a big box, and it's just this like the poster, and it's very you know, eye catching, and very, like, you can just feel the lies of the poster. Like, there's no way this movie is anywhere near as exciting as that poster. And as it turns out, this is a really dark, really bleak, and surprisingly engaging serial killer film.
And it's oddball,
oddball.
It's a serial killer movie. It's a procedural of sorts, with so many fucking characters and so many different subplots going in different directions. And you see how they all get pulled together as they pull the threads on this tale. You're like, oh, I see how this works. But for a long time, like, especially the first 20 minutes, you're like, the fuck is this? Like, yeah. Okay, so there's a girl who is a clairvoyant who draws pictures of murder scenes.
She had the power to see things beyond the normal range of human senses. She saw a murder.
And there's a cop who does stand-up comedy and who's moonlighting as a stand-up at the comic strip.
This is all the first 5 minutes of the movie. So by the fifth minute, I literally, like, I started watching this and Cargo was like, hey, should we watch that? Is it, you know, you started watching it. Isn't it good? And I was like, it's weird. It's weird enough that I want to see where it goes, because in the first 5 minutes, we're introduced to a woman who draws pictures of murder scenes and a cop who's moonlighting as a stand-up comic.
And a beat news journalist, you know, a TV news journalist who's just gotten his first morning show.
Yeah.
And is doing the morning show beat. And then you've got three very serious cops, all played by veteran character actors.
One of them a very young, surprisingly thin John Polito, excuse me.
Yeah.
Who is a frequent collaborator of the Coen brothers. So you may have seen him in Miller's Crossing, Barton Fink, Big Lebowski, like, yeah. And, you know, and on top of that, you know, any, again, like, this is a guy who you would have seen in things like Highlander, Rocketeer, The Crow. I mean, he's in a lot of geek movies.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And so you've got these three veteran character actor cops who are trying to solve this crime while you've got these three oddball main characters all off on their own weird subplots.
Yeah.
And how does it all weave together? Well, that's what makes this movie interesting. Now, the thing is this is not a great movie.
No, it's a
deeply flawed movie. But at the same time, what it's doing is so interesting and different. The closest comparison I could make with this is New Year's Evil, in terms of how it's a serial killer movie that goes in such weird directions that you're just fascinated by all the choices they make that you've never seen done before.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. This is a movie where I don't really want to talk about the ending, because I want you guys to go and discover this, because the only ways to see this are for free.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there was actually an option to pay to rent or buy The Killing Hour on Amazon. I think it was only available through Prime. And then it's on YouTube. I think this is one of those movies that if you want to watch it, you can't pay for it. So, but it is, just the way this unravels. Essentially, what's cool about it though is, you know, these murders, it's all about this murderer that they refer to as the handcuff murderer, because that's how original, it's like the least original part of this very original movie, except the handcuff murders are actually really kind of cool and grisly.
I really liked the way they did those, because I was like, I don't know.
No, just referring to him as the handcuff killer.
Oh, just referring.
Just like, okay, it's, yeah, just like, it's, yeah. And like, really, his motif is handcuffs? It's like, yeah. And when you see what he does with handcuffs, it's kind of like, oh, what a horrible way to die.
Yeah.
That's awful. Oh, well, another horrible way to die. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, he's kind of this weird proto-Jigsaw type killer. And, you know, he finds interesting ways. I was actually thinking about Sinister as I watched it. Like, all of these really creative ways that he's found to kill people with handcuffs. I was like, it's a lot like a lot of creative ways to kill people around the house in ways that kind of feel like home videos but aren't home videos. But, you know, and I want to go back for a second to this woman who draws pictures of murder scenes. It's weird to me. The weirdest part of this movie is how, I won't say unnecessary, but how secondary to the plot the eponymous clairvoyant really is.
Yeah.
Because she's the one that kind of finally fits the pieces together. But by the time that happens, it's not like Agent Kuyon in The Usual Suspects. It's more like, oh, we were kind of getting to that anyway based on things that we've seen. So instead we've got Mutt and Jeff, and by that I mean the police officer who's moonlighting as a stand-up comic who is getting in trouble for it. He may lose his police pension, but if it's any consolation, he does a pretty mediocre George Burns impression, so there's that. And
that,
then
that's being very generous.
You know.
Like, no, his Woody Allen was mediocre. His George Burns is fucking awful.
And then you have this talk show host who's just like, dude, you just retired from that game show and you're going to be back to it in a month because you're not very good at this. And these are the two guys who are ipso facto tasked with solving this murder, because the actual police force is relying too much on the woman who draws pictures. Every time she draws a picture, she's back in the station. They're like, oh, yes, thank you for bringing this in. We need to analyze this. And I'm just like, no, you don't. Well, you have no proof that she's a clairvoyant at all.
That's because, but that's kind of what's so interesting about this. And that brings us into Joe Morton, is Joe Morton's essentially the Donnie of this movie. Joe Morton is he's the guy who's this good cop who's gone to college, who knows exactly what he's doing. And he knows all of these procedures and knows all of the new technology in order to, you know, properly solve this crime. And all his sergeant can seem to do is say, shut the fuck up, Donnie. You know, every time he's like, well, we should be, oh, college boy coming in with this college way of solving our crimes. You know what? You need to check your gut. And it's like, no, he's right. And like, you keep watching Joe Morton get stomped down and you're not sure if it's like old school New York embedded racism or if it's, you know, just anti-intellectualism or what it is about this. But he keeps, Joe Morton keeps saying exactly what they need to be doing and they keep preventing him from doing it. So the cops end up being inept.
So inept. But what's crazy about it is even when you have inept cops, even when you have a precinct that seems to be more concerned about charcoal drawings from a crazy lady than doing any actual police work, Joe Morton is still the guy delivering exposition. He's still the guy in an authoritative position going, nope, this is what happened. Here's all the evidence. Here are the clues. He's getting shot down all the time. And yet at the same time, he's so in command of the screen in those moments. And he has such a genuine authority. He's just like, it's so natural for him that it never feels like an exposition delivery system, even though that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's another testament to how good this guy is, even that early on in his career.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's odd. This movie was made 2 years before Brother from Another Planet, and he looks 10 years older in this than he does in Brother from Another Planet.
Yeah, he looks so much older in this movie.
Well, because he's got the old school, you know, early 80s mustache and the cropped hair, and, you know, then he goes to Brother from Another Planet, and he's clean shaven, he's got the cool short, you know, dreads, and here he's not given as much to play with, but every scene he's in, he's fucking in. Like, absolutely. Even when he's just standing in the background, he's fucking commanding that
scene. Here is how good Joe Morton is in this movie.
How good is he?
What's my number one pet peeve in horror films?
Not enough titty?
No. You know what my number one pet peeve in horror films is.
What is your number one pet peeve in horror films?
When they kill the dog. I hate it when dogs die in horror films. Joe Morton shoots a dog in this movie, and I'm like, he had to do it. Like, I am on Joe Morton's side, and it's my biggest pet peeve in horror films, and I'm still just like, yep, gotta do what you gotta do, Joe Morton.
Dude, you know, and that's a scene I wanted to talk about. There's this great scene where the cops are sent on what we already know is a red herring. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because we already know what's really going on, and we're ahead of the cops. And they bust in to arrest this guy who's the red herring, and they get the drop on him. They're really smart about it. They got him. And then the dude's mom comes in and starts screaming at the cops and distracts them. And this guy makes a break for it. But does so in a way that warrants a police shooting.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they, you know, the, and you just named him and his name is already, one of the cops,
John Polito.
Yeah. John Polito shoots him. And in that moment, he and Joe Morton share this amazing, like, 5 seconds where you just see him destroyed for having killed another human being. And Joe Morton just being so human with him and just like, oh, fuck, dude. I know exactly how you feel. Holy shit. Like, and it's just in a movie that's got some really weird moments and bits of wooden acting, there's like this really profound 5 seconds. It's just like, this is what happens when you take two great actors and give them something real to chew on. And the director doesn't give a shit what you're doing with it. So just go with it.
Yeah.
And they do. And it's just that scene really is like this beacon of light of just seeing the talent of these two great character actors, just doing this amazing thing, with this, the one moment they're given in the film to not just be expositional cops.
Yeah. And to bring it full circle to Brother from Another Planet and how the issue is never as simple as it seems, Joe Morton's character is also the only cop that speaks Spanish in this movie.
Yes.
He's the only one, which is why the mother's yelling at him, because he can actually talk back to her.
Yeah.
None of the other cops seem to speak Spanish except for Joe Morton, which is really interesting. And yeah, this is not a great film, but it is definitely a film worth checking out, because right up until its ending, I think its ending is really effectively bleak. Like, there's no, in any other movie, there would have been a very cheaply purchased, you know, string score to like heighten the tension. And at the ending of this movie, in that moment, it's just, you just hear the wind blow and it makes it a 10 times more effective scene. Yeah. And I really dug this.
Yeah. And it's the thing is it's a movie that when you're watching it, it feels like it could be lazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time you get to the end, you realize how not lazy it is.
Exactly.
And it was very deliberate the whole time. And that every weird character tick, every weird subplot actually all plays into telling this story in the way that this story actually works and makes sense. So nothing in this movie is superfluous.
Right.
It's just odd.
Very odd.
And that's what's cool about it.
But it all comes together very well. And I hope this episode came together very well for you. We're big fans of Joe Morton here.
Big fans.
Really happy to feature him first in this series. If you want to check out more of his films, he's also in Speed, American Gangster. He actually has a really great run on Smallville from the early seasons. Executive Decision, Paycheck. Like, I mean, he's just been in everything. Like,
yeah, no, you've seen this guy dozens of times. And if you haven't seen any of the movies we talked about in this episode, you owe it to yourself to go and spend some time with Joe Morton, especially, dear God, Brother from Another Planet. You're not going to see, there is no other movie like that. It's just its own beast. And I'm really glad we finally got to talk about Joe Morton, because he's just fucking amazing.
And in this episode, of course, we're going to talk about the junk food pairing. And this one, Carg, I'm going to let you talk about, because you suggested this, and I think it's very apropos. So what is the junk food pairing for the Joe Morton episode?
The junk food pairing is something I discovered just a few short years ago. The pumpkin pear pie.
What?
It is a pumpkin pear pie. It is an autumnal offering from the north. I first discovered it in Minnesota. It is a delicious pairing of two things that sound like they should not go together. The creaminess of a pumpkin pie topped off with, you know, caramelized pears just seems odd. But the thing is that Brother from Another Planet features a scene in which Joe Morton steals a pear because he's starving, and it's a very interesting scene. But like Brother from Another Planet, this is a weird mishmash of things that actually has a lot of depth of flavor and is really, really so much better than you could ever imagine it would be, just by hearing about what it is. And that's very much Morton's career. Morton's career is a very flavorful, deep range of performances that he always delivers, much like a pumpkin pear pie.
I also love that the junk food pairing is a pear pairing to pumpkin. So, you know, say that five times fast and see if you can do it. Well, thanks for joining us, guys, here on Junk Food Cinema. I want to remind you, yet again, we are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargo, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or on Twitter at twitter.com/massaworm.
Right on. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, or you can find me on Facebook, my Facebook page, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic, but not order, apparently, because I can't speak for shit. And also check out oneofus.net, my home away from home. Lots of great geek podcasts and blogs over there. And please do use those Amazon links. Whatever movies are available that we've talked about, we will definitely throw up there. The Clairvoyant will probably not be one of them, sadly.
Well, it is on Amazon, but it's on Amazon Prime.
Well, there you go. You can still actually get your hands on a copy of that. But we're going to close this out. And until next time, if you're looking for something to watch, why not sit down to Netflix, sit down to Amazon Prime, order something from Amazon. Just make sure you're sitting down to a nice hot cup of Joe Morton, that is.